Welcome to the Last Sunday Podcast, where we discuss last Sunday's sermon at Majestic View Church in beautiful Kiowa, Colorado. Senior Pastor John Smith talks with Kyle Peters to answer questions, provide clarity, and take a deeper dive on some points from the sermon. This is your chance to be a fly on the wall for personal discipleship. So welcome back to our short week, because you got to spend a little time with your family, I hear, on Monday.
Yeah. Well, Deb and I worked in the yard.
Fantastic.
I'm trying to catch up from being gone all summer.
There you go. Well, we at my house, we got you beat. We worked on the family budget on Monday.
Well, I enjoyed mine.
You know what? We actually do, too. We closed out August. Because we're now, you know, into September, and we've for several years now we've been doing the Financial Peace University program from Dave Ramsey,
and
it has
cool.
been very aptly named, I find, because not only does it bring financial peace to our house, but I feel like we've gotten a lot closer and better as a family and as a couple.
Well, that's really cool.
Because of that, so
that's really cool.
We're still working on paying off the house, but other than that. We are free and clear. I'm not declaring anything until that's done, though, because that's a big one. So last Sunday we talked about, well, we covered a lot of ground and got into some cool stuff. I feel like you touched on a lot of topics that could be their own podcast, probably somebody else's podcast in a lot of situations too.
Right.
that were really awesome, and if you want to break into any of those topics, feel free. But my first question was a revelation that I had, because a lot of what you had for Sunday was based off of the Book of Revelation and the symbolism of the lamb and how many times that was used. But before you got into all that, just saying that it's the Book of Revelation and not Revelations, and I don't know why, but that stuck out to me. And I get thinking about it, like when I was growing up, if somebody said, oh, you know, he preaches out of the Book of Revelation, then there was something going on there. You know, there was kind of, it was almost like it was a taboo part of the Bible to get into. So I guess my first question is, because I realized that I have not read, sitting down with the Bible, turning pages, I've never read the whole Bible. I've had it on audiobook and whatnot, and I've jumped around as time goes on, whatnot. But I've never just sat down to it, so I'm working on that. But Revelation's at the wrong side of the book for me to speak to it today with any authority, because I haven't gotten there yet. So what is the Revelation? Why is this book important to us?
Well, it's to make that distinction that it is the Revelation. But we don't stop there. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ. And what you got to understand, it's the same thing in essence that we had with the word lamb and the development of the whole concept that Jesus Christ was the Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world. That is culminated, and that picture, not just picture, but the reality of who Jesus is and what he was to us when he came to this earth, what he means to us by coming to this earth as the Lamb who died for our sins, that is culminated in the revelation of Jesus Christ. Because now we don't just get to see him as Redeemer, but we get to see him as the Redeemer who's coming back. And now we get to see him in all of his glory. We get to see him as God. We get to see him as the judge. We get to see him as as the Redeemer. We get to see him as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. We get to see him as the one who is protecting his martyrs and loving his martyrs and those that stand up for him. It's just really the culmination of the whole picture of who Jesus is. So it is the revelation of Jesus Christ. One other thing before I leave that is that when we study the Bible for facts, for information, for intellectual knowledge, we miss it. The Bible is to reveal to us the person of God and how much He loves us, how much the Father loves us, the work of the Holy Spirit in our lives, the redemption of Jesus Christ and all that He is. And so the Bible doesn't come alive. It doesn't mean anything to us spiritually if it doesn't bring us into a greater understanding of who God is. Let me give you an example. I don't know if you and your wife ever wrote love letters to each other.
A little bit. Admittedly, probably too long ago.
Well, yes.
Yes.
But the thing is especially if you were ever separated from each other by distance, when you got that letter in the mail, now we've lost that with texting and emailing and all that stuff, but when you got that letter in the mail in her handwriting, did you just read it once?
No, absolutely not.
I mean, you read it and then you read it again. When I was in White Swan, Washington as a summer missionary, Deborah and I had just started dating the prior March to that. I was there for 9 weeks. I was, separated from her. We were seriously dating, but we weren't real serious yet. I was real serious, but I don't think she was. But anyway, she was so faithful. I would get 2 or 3 letters a week from her. Nice. And oh my goodness, that was my lifeline to back home. I was in a very different culture. I was working on the Indian reservation in White Swan, Washington. And very different thing. And the work up there was challenging, but it was lonely. And man, to get those letters and to read between the lines and to know this woman cared enough about me to write me, ooh, my goodness. Well, when you start studying the Bible as a love letter from God, it helps us to see His nature. It helps us to see His character. It helps us to see who He is. Then it's a whole different book.
So you just said, leading into that, though, that there's a problem with kind of taking a scholarly approach to it.
Yeah, most people study the Bible from an intellectual point of view so that they will get knowledge, so that they will get theology, so that they will get doctrine. And there's nothing wrong with the doctrine. Doctrine's not a dirty word. Theology's not a word. But you know what theology really is? You know the definition of the word?
No.
It's the study of God.
Okay.
But we see theology as all these facts instead of, instead of really discovering God as a person.
So it's kind of missing the forest for the trees, or not seeing the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
Where if I'm just, I guess, it sounds like maybe it makes a difference then on what my purpose for being there is. Mm-hmm. If my purpose for opening the Bible is to be able to make a good argument, which we talked about apologetics last week, and I see a lot of that kind of thing, and quite frankly, it just bores me at this point. I see a lot of those videos on YouTube or whatnot where two people will get into an argument, and one guy is really good at spouting off facts. So if I'm just going at it from that standpoint, I'm probably missing a lot. I want to win an argument. I want to show good faith.
Let me ask you. I'm gonna put you on the spot. I'm gonna ask you a question. Okay.
Right.
On Sunday, when I preach, what stories impact you the most? Are they stories that are just a factual? Are they when I just give facts? Or are they stories when I share something that God has done personally for my life as I've got to know Him. Which one do you remember the most?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. And it's not just when they impact your life. It's that if that story impacts or parallels my own life, which all of our lives parallel each other to some degree. So yeah, a personal anecdotal story, it has a lot more impact and it relates to my life more, even more than if it was the life of someone else. You know, we read about the woman at the well. I don't know why that just popped in my head, but that one popped into my head. That's not an overly relatable story to me, even though it's a story about a person's life. And she did not have a great life leading up to that point. And that was the whole point was, hey, I know you've had a bad life, and it's okay. So, but yeah, bringing it closer to home always, yeah, makes a much bigger impact.
Well, I had a professor teach me very young, very early in my education, when you preach from your head, you reach somebody's head. When you preach from your heart, you touch people's hearts. But when you preach from your life, you are God's tool to change lives.
Hmm.
So the whole thing is, I can't preach from my life if it's about me. I'm talking about preaching from my life and how I have discovered God. That's the way people say, oh, if that little short guy can do that, then so can I. I can discover God too. Oh, he's just a real person. He's just a common guy. And God's changed his life, and God speaks to his heart and shows him things in the Word. Maybe I could too.
Well, and isn't that the purpose of all of us? You know, I think we all search for purpose in life. But isn't that our one true purpose is to spread the Word and to...
Well, that's the way we give God the glory.
Yeah.
We give God the glory as we become His vessels for Him to shine the light through us. Any light that's in my eyes, any light that's in my life is not the light of John Smith, or it's not the true light. If it is the light of the Lord as He is transforming my life, then all of a sudden it's a light that will change other people, that will impact other people.
So I feel like this is moving past my points on that. I jotted down some notes because I wanted to make sure that we got on things. But you've moved right to my next point, and I want to roll with it because you talked about worship at the end of the sermon, and the predominant question that kept popping into my head while I was listening to you was. And I think it was like the shortest last little segment of your sermon was, what is worship? Like what is it? What should it be? What should I be doing? What do people worship incorrectly?
Oh, absolutely. And people worship all kinds of things.
And I guess this does get into this, but not the worshiping of some other deity or something. But if I'm focused on God, I'm focused on the Christian faith. Can I do that in the wrong way? And what is the right way?
Okay, well, let's use some secular examples to help us unpack that a little bit.
Okay.
If somebody watches me with my wife and they say, man, he worships her.
Mm-hmm.
That means I cherish her. That means that she is preeminent in my life. That means they look at me and say, boy, she's the only woman for him.
All good things.
Right. And I, not that I should worship my wife, but she should be number one and I should cherish her.
Mm-hmm.
But when we worship God, the right way to worship Him is to make Him the only one we worship. That we truly give our adoration and praise to, and we consciously recognize there is no one comparable, there is no thing comparable to God. When, back to the relationship with my wife, and what would make somebody say that about me if they saw me with her? It would be because I talk about her all the time. Mm-hmm. It would be because I look at her with light in my eyes, you know. It would be because I have made her a focal point of who I am. Well, God says, there shall be no other gods before me. If you're going to really worship me, mm-hmm. I'm to be that focal point of your life. I'm the one that you are to love above all others. And, you know, when we begin to discover that, then it just opens the pathway for God to speak to us, because he knows that he really is going to get glory from our lives. And it's not that God is some egotist that has to have, he doesn't need me to give him glory. I need to be the one that gives him glory for my benefit, for my joy. I mean, this next Sunday, we're going to talk about some of the foundational principles of having joy in your life. And as we do that, one of the foundational ways that it takes for you to really have joy is for you to learn how to stop and worship God. When you deal in the workforce with secular people, mm-hmm. How high on the list of problems is self-focus and selfishness?
it's usually pretty high.
I would say it's right up there when you're dealing with people with pride, which is kind of the same thing.
Right.
Okay. Yep. What worship does for me is I consciously take my eyes off of John and put my eyes on the supreme God of heaven, who is superior to all. And that makes John about this big, you know, and I'm pulling my fingers together about an eighth of an inch here, you know.
So I think an easy question to ask here that is probably kind of an inappropriate question in a way, but it's an easy question, I think, for a lot of people to come up with is, why does God do that? Why God's selfish? You know, why do I have to say, hey, you're the great? He knows he's the greatest. He created the entire universe in 6 days. So why do I need to do that? But at the same time, I'm seeing in what you just said, I'm seeing the huge benefit of making myself no longer the focus, no longer I'm making myself smaller. And by doing that, I can, I'm not focused inward so much, because why would I? I'm pretty insignificant in a lot of ways. So why focus myself inward? I need to focus outward on other people mm-hmm. and other things. And, you know, for me, for you, God is definitely the number one thing on that list. For a lot of people, he's not. But I think that lesson's still there.
Well, when I take my time to worship God, it naturally takes me a place of love and service to other people. Mm-hmm. When my worship of God comes out of a love relationship with him, okay? But the thing that God does for us when we worship him is he fills our heart with love for others. That, you know, this self-focus, loving yourself in the negative connotation of that, being self-focused, mm-hmm. selfish, it's a lonely place. And it is a place that makes you, that people will ostracize you. That they don't want to be around somebody that's like that. That's a definition of a jerk, okay?
Well, and we celebrate it in this culture now.
Yeah.
In our culture here in the United States, we celebrate that. Songs have hit the number one spot on the charts of, I can buy myself flowers. You know, well, good for you, but it is. It's lonely. It's.
But when I, when so I worship my God, it's very natural for me to get up off my knees, or however I'm choosing to worship that day, or however I'm meeting with God. It's very natural for me to get up, and the first thing is think about somebody else, what their needs are. Whether that's Deborah, the person I live with,
mm-hmm.
or it's the person I'm going to meet at the church for a counseling appointment, or, you know, my neighbor across the street, or somebody the Lord just puts on my heart. Well, because now that I've worshiped Him, His love, He gives me back more than I could ever give Him, okay? And He fills my heart with that so that I'm able to go serve. You know, the other day, you asked me a very personal question about how I deal with all the grief that comes my way, with the problems of people that comes my way. I can't, as a human being, there's only so much of that you can process, and your cup gets way full,
mm-hmm.
and it's not full of good stuff, okay? So when the love of God is poured into our hearts, then instead of taking that upon ourselves, we say, okay, what can I do to help? And then it's not, oh, poor, poor, pitiful me. Believe me, I have those pity parties. But it's not about poor, poor, pitiful me. It is a compassion that only comes from God. Now I can give this to somebody else, and I can meet them in their hour of need. That's just God coming through us. That's His love. And we experience that, and we get that from His Word and from worshiping Him.
Yeah, I think that's... I think that's definitely something that we're missing, and I see. You know, I used to work around a lot of bad stuff, a lot of the worst things in society and whatnot, and those things can really weigh on people. You know, our law enforcement, military, fire folks, they see a lot of bad things, and people in general, I think, just can see a lot of things, and we're subjected to so much imagery that's not good anyway. And we carry that with us, and if we don't have a method to release it, to let it off of our shoulders, we think we have to carry that burden.
Well, there again, when we have the problem, that we begin to get weighted down with that stuff, mm-hmm. what's our focus? I can't take anymore.
Yep, we just look in ourselves.
We got the images in our brain, in our minds, and we keep seeing those over and over, instead of seeing the need in the person that maybe is even impacted more than we are. And how do I care about that person?
So is that, if I take that time, is that worship time not just a time of thanks, but a time of unburdening as well?
It's a time of, God is, well, let's give another analogy, practical illustration. When your child comes to you,
mm-hmm.
we've talked a lot about your daughter, now you got a son as well.
Yep.
When your children come to you and they say, Daddy, can I talk? And you see that there's a sadness in their face. And they're going to, as they get older, you're going to see stuff like that, and they're going to be hesitant to talk to you. But when they do talk to you, does that warm your heart that they would trust you with that?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and that's something within my family, and I noticed that my family, we're kind of weird in this, but I don't care because I like it, that we strive to speak more openly with each other. We strive to, like, it's a conscious effort. It's a topic of conversation that we will have conversations. And that we will not avoid conflict. We will embrace it and use it positively. And
well, that's good, brother.
My daughter right now is learning, because she's doing the very human thing, and we attribute it as being the girl thing, but it's a human thing of what's wrong? Nothing. Well, that's nonsense, and we all know it. And so And I went through this with my wife too at first, you know, where it was, what's wrong? No, nothing. And she was very unused to being able to speak openly. But so there's a great book on this that it's called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. It's a business book, and I love it because everybody, you know, our families are a team. This church is a team, and one of the top dysfunctions is failure to embrace conflict, mm-hmm. or a fear of embracing conflict. And then that all stems from a lack of trust.
Mm-hmm. You know, I can say this to Majestic View Church, and I'm not going to go into details, but just last night, our elders had a meeting. And we had an issue that we were not agreed on. And there was one of us that was not on board with the others. Mm-hmm. But there was such an amazing desire in the room from everybody to be open, to let that person that had a different view of things be able to express themselves. They were not belittled for their feelings. And this morning, after everybody had slept on everything, and we did not leave here, there was no anger in the room, there were no raised voices, none of that stuff, okay? So I don't want anybody to start thinking that.
Yeah.
But this morning, the texting started. And it was all about, we are unified. And this person led the way in that. We are together, and it was just appreciation for each other. It was the sweetest thing to watch as it all came together. And that's a big deal. And I hadn't really thought about it last night. But, yeah, it was a safe place because mm-hmm. it was not comfortable to disagree, especially when it's, you know, potentially 3-1 or even 2-2, you know.
Right.
When you're standing on something that you believe that's different, that's hard. But if it's love that says, no, hey, bro, we need this. We need the iron sharpening and iron. We need yep. to all look at this together. And probably at the end, we're going to have to modify our position. Everybody's going to have to, you know.
Well, and again, there's trust there. And I've been in one of those meetings before. And and yeah, it's very clear. You guys have a trust that's built up over time, and hopefully, our families are doing the same thing. I think sometimes we probably do a pretty good job of tearing apart that trust too. But ideally, we're constantly building that trust. And you know, if my son or my daughter come to me, or my wife comes to me and says, "Hey, I've got a problem." Actually, last night, as you mentioned this, my wife and I had a conflict in this space, and I had to say, hey, you were holding that in. And I didn't even realize it was a problem at first, which shame on me. But as time went on, I realized there was a problem, and I realized that problem was oddly Kyle-shaped, and that I had caused all of this and failed to recognize it, that it even existed. And but I also had to push back on her, which this is, I think, kind of leading into one of my last points here on worship that came up in that segment. I had to scold my wife a little bit for not communicating that to me. And one of the things I said to her was, that's not how we act with each other. We confront these things so that we get them off of our plate, we get them off of our chest as soon as possible. We don't let those things stew.
Right. Well, you know, Kyle, I talk a lot about this. The number one issue of Scripture, in my opinion, as I've studied the Word of God for a long time, is relationships. And when we learn to worship God, gonna bring us all back to where
yes,
we started.
Yes.
When we learn to worship God and we learn to have intimacy with God, you don't have intimacy with God if you're not transparent with God, because that means you're being transparent with yourself, right? And because God knows it, whether you say it or not.
Right.
Okay, but when we learn to do that and find that safe place with the Lord, a safe place of forgiveness and acceptance and love, then it opens up the door for intimacy with our wives, with our children, with a brother, you know, with other people. And I'm telling you what, Americans are bankrupt when it comes to having real relationships.
Well, and is it the same thing then? Is it a lack of trust?
Yeah, we don't want to trust anybody.
Well, and people don't trust God.
Right. But you start getting that trust right with God and find out who you are and how much He loves you, then honestly, you kind of get to a point where it doesn't matter how you feel about me because I know how God feels about me.
Right.
Now, that's not true. I do care, and it does matter how you feel about me. But yet, it's a lot different because I'm not living my life based upon popular opinion. I'm living my life based upon the one who died for me on the cross and loves me.
So that takes me into another line of thought that I've been dealing with for quite some time. And it's starting to build even more here as the days and weeks are ticking along here. So it's a very timely thing with me of who I'm pleasing, who others are pleasing, and how I conduct myself around other people. And for so society's falling off the rails, and I don't think even the most skeptical of us would argue that. It might just be an argument of what the cause is, but as I move through life and I'm dealing with exactly what you said, who do I please? I know who I need to please, but if I'm doing what God tells me to do, and it's exactly 180 degrees opposite of what society is asking for right now, I'm probably doing the right thing. I get it. But that's hard. Mm-hmm. And it's not just that it's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to do. I think of, here local-ish up in Denver, the Masterpiece Cake Shop guy who just said, I'm not making your cake. A very simple thing with profound and deep impact on our whole nation. But he stood up to that. And I think he did the right thing, but did he do the right? How do we deal with this on a day-to-day basis, especially, let's just say I've got somebody who I disagree with, and that disagreement can be all kinds of things. It can be homosexuality. It can be politics. It can be any kind of thing. How do I deal with that and do the right thing? And I don't want to say I'd not offend them, but because, they might need to be offended a little bit. But at the same time, I don't want to be rude. I don't want to offend them, Well,
as you were talking about that, an example came to me. We, in our culture, have wrong definitions of very important stuff, okay? And that's why our culture is unwinding. One of those definitions, one of those words that we define inappropriately is the word love.
I was thinking that as you were saying that.
Love in the American music, movies, American culture says, if you love me, you'll give me what I want.
Mm-hmm.
But love doesn't give us what we want. Real God's love gives us unconditional acceptance, but it also gives us what we need. And, the age-old thing, the teenage boy in a dark car with his girlfriend, if you love me, you'll...
Fill in the blank, yeah, whatever.
Okay? That's not love, that's lust.
Right.
That's what I want. That's not the best interest of that relationship. God told us that. So for him to do that is inappropriate. For her to do that is inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this culture says, what? I never heard of that before. Unfortunately, that's where we are. But the truth of the matter is that you can take that principle across the board. When we please God, it frees us to do the right thing and to give real love, which is giving people what they need. It's not what they want. You know what? If you really love me as a brother and you see that I'm about to do something really stupid and you say, oh, well, you don't love me. Because if you really love me and you see that I'm about to do something that's going to harm myself, it's going to change the course of my family, my whole life, and you say, man, at least you warned me. Because real love says, I care too much about you not to tell you the truth.
And maybe that's falling back to the reference to the five dysfunctions of a team, that embracing conflict or not avoiding conflict isn't a license to fight. It's saying the kind truth. It's where your heart is. It's where you're coming from on it that matters.
Well, earlier you mentioned the woman at the well that Jesus talked to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've all seen the movies where the people are angrily shouting at somebody, you're a wicked person, you're a harlot, whatever it is this person has done. Well, that day that Jesus met that woman at the well, first of all, he showed her all kinds of kindness. And he did the unthinkable. He, as a Jewish man, spoke to a Samaritan. A Samaritan wasn't even just a Gentile. They were, in the term that we would understand in America today, they were half-breeds. They were half-Gentile, half-Jewish, which made them even more despicable to the Jewish people in that day. A very terrible prejudice, okay? Jesus did the unthinkable. He actually spoke to this woman a kind word. And then he asked her for a drink of water. She had the power to do that because she had the pot. He didn't. And so when he asked her for that, he began to have this conversation with her. And he didn't look at her and say, you know, you're a slut. You're an immoral woman. He looked at her with compassion, trying to meet her needs. And she said, I've done this or that. And he said, I know. And you've had five husbands.
he didn't say, I know what you've done in an accusatory manner. He said, he was basically saying, I'm sitting here talking to you, and I know where you come from.
Yeah.
And I'm still talking to you.
That's right. I care about you. I care about you more than I care about what you've done. Now, he wasn't excusing what she's done.
Right.
And that is what real love is. And that is back to where we started with this thing, when you say, okay, if I'm pleasing God, I may not be pleasing man. Well, we get that all mixed up, thinking that it's our job to condemn every wrong. No, our job is to love people, and sometimes we have to take a stand. You know, there's some things that I just don't do. Now, for me to say, you shouldn't do that, no. You may say, would you like, okay, you offer me a cigarette, okay? That's something that's on a lot of people's list today, all right?
All right.
It's not a very, so I'll use that one. That might be a little safe, okay?
All right.
But you offer me a cigarette, and I don't say, you dirty, rotten sucker, you trying to get me cancer? No, I look at you and say, you know, bro, I've made a decision. I'm not going to smoke.
Right.
If you want to, that's your business. That's not something I'm going to do. And it's not me condemning you. It's just that's a decision I've decided to make for my health.
All right, so let's go down the danger road here then. Let's do pronouns. If somebody wants me to use their preferred pronouns and not, how do I even want to say this at this moment? I guess not how the English language works according to how I was taught anyway. If I refuse that, I don't want to, again, yeah, like you just said, I don't want to come at them from a hateful angle. I want to love them. I want to embrace them. I want to help them. But I also don't want to be complicit in a lie.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this past week, I mentioned in my sermon last Sunday, I mentioned in my sermon that I went to see the movie Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
Actually, Reagan's the title of it. But anyway, Reagan was a master at redirecting situations mm-hmm. with humor, with kindness, but with firmness. And he took some amazing stands that it took a lot of courage to do, okay? But when he would disarm somebody, he'd make everybody in the room laugh.
Yes.
Okay, so what I'm saying is I don't think there's a formula for anyone's thing. I think what you do, I think a lot of times one of the approaches I would take, if somebody said, you know, a man obviously wants me to call him a she, I would say, you know, maybe I would explore that a little bit and say, well, you know, I don't want to be offensive here, but help me. I'm an old man. I'm 65 years old. And it's pretty obvious to me that you weren't born a she, okay? So talk to me. What's that about? Explain to me how you came to that. And say, you know, after they've had a chance and create dialogue and show genuine interest in that person instead of just, you know, hatred or angst, whatever the word right. you want to use there. And then at the end of the day, I'd probably look at them and say, listen, I can't promise you because it's so ingrained in this old man. My memory is just not that good. And I have lived my life saying, okay, that's obviously a man. And so without even thinking, I'll do it. I'm not trying to be offensive. I'm not trying, it's not about you. It's about what I see. You know, if I see a blue car out there in the parking lot, I'm not going to call it a red car just because I've learned to identify the color blue. So what I'm saying is we engage people and then we maybe put it on us and say, I'm just too feeble-minded to work this out, okay?
Right.
And I don't mean it because I don't care about you. I don't mean it because I hate you. I disagree with you, but, you know, this is where I'm at.
Well, and maybe it is that approach of I'm not here to hate you. And that person, and I'm obviously thinking of a particular encounter that I've had, you know, a particular person and whatnot recently. And that person's probably anticipating a negatively oriented confrontation. They're probably not anticipating a caring standpoint mm-hmm. if it gets brought up at all. And so it's incumbent upon me to push that in a positive light, to be who I need to be there, not who I want. I may want to be and be confrontational in a negative way.
Well, you know, again, we've got to go back to what Jesus did. And one of the greatest tools that Jesus used throughout all of his ministry was he asked questions. Mm. Instead of making a declarative statement, woman, you're a harlot. No. He asked questions.
Right.
And in the course of that doing that, he was able to ask those questions, not in a, again, not an accusatory tone. It's just like, you know, okay, you've raised this issue with me. Let's talk a minute because I'm confused. And then if the focus is right here on me and my confusion, not their confusion.
Now, I have also noticed, though, that He never gives in. He never compromises himself.
Nope.
But he's always accepting, I guess. I struggle with that because I feel like that's the wrong word. But at the same time,
but real love does meet a person where they're at. Okay, let me give you an example of something I said in a sermon here recently before we started doing our podcast. I made the statement of where our youth are today, and people my age, by the way, it's always been this way. It was this way when I was a teenager. They look and say, oh, what's this? What's this young people coming to today?
Right. But look at Elvis and those hips. You know, yeah. Yeah, it's always something.
But when you see the dilemma and the culture that children are being born into today, mm-hmm. and what so many kids see that they should not see before they're 3 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know a man very well that's gotten victory over this, but he was exposed to pornography when he was 4 years old.
Goodness.
Now, four-year-olds shouldn't be seeing that.
No.
But there's a whole lot of houses in America that the TV is on 24/7 and nobody's monitoring what's on the TV. Or maybe they are monitoring, but they just don't care. Mm-hmm. So when children see that and they're exposed to that, then are they confused? How could they not be confused? Because they're getting this message from Hollywood, they're getting another message from this person, another message from this person, and it's confusing. So when I see especially young people that are confused about their sexual identity, I go, instead of me being angry at them, instead of me ostracizing them, I need to embrace them by saying, hey, where are you at? I mean, how did you come to this place? Show genuine interest in them and open the door for them to have dialogue and to talk to somebody, because there's probably, I'm not going to be universal here, but there's a high probability, there's a lot of pain there.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's confusion. I don't like being confused. Do you like being confused?
No. Well, you know, and so I read something recently that was talking about a different subject, but it was the one opportunity, not church-related, that might be the one opportunity that a young person has to enter a church. And to that end, or to that spirit here, we might be the one shining light in their life. We might be the one person who genuinely asked and didn't, maybe not, I don't even want to go so far as to say without judgment, but less. Maybe we have less judgment in our voices. We have less, maybe, hatred in our voices. We might be that one person that gives them a little glimmer of hope that confusion might be able to go away.
Well, yeah, and that somebody really cares about them.
Yeah.
It cares about their dilemma. One of the first things you learn when you start studying counseling, and I'm not a licensed counselor, so I can't even call it counseling legally, okay?
Right.
But when I've had quite a bit of training in that, and one of the first things you do is you have to show somebody you really care about them. You have to care about their situation. And that you're not going to condemn them. You're certainly not going to shout what they've done on the rooftops to other people.
Right.
That's that confidentiality thing. But the most important thing is, do they sense compassion? Do they sense that this person cares about me? And if they don't, you're barking up a tree. You won't have a chance to help that person, because it takes love first.
So I guess as we go forward, we just need to make sure we're going forward with the right spirit, doing the things that God asked us to do.
Jesus said, if you keep my commandments, then you show you love me. And my love will come through you. And I'm going to talk about that this coming Sunday.
I'm excited to hear it.
As we talk about that.
So. I know joy has been a topic of conversation in a lot of circles here lately. So I have a feeling that you're going to be coming at it from a different standpoint.
We're starting through the book of Philippians.
Okay.
And the primary theme of the book of Philippians is joy. And the backdrop of Philippians is it's written by a man, and as his pen goes across the page, you can hear the rattle of the shackles on his wrist because he was in prison.
Hmm.
And he is the one that gives us probably the primary book of the Bible about joy.
All right. Well, Until next Sunday, then.
All right, bro. Thank you very much. Looking forward to it, and we'll be looking forward to next week.
Absolutely.
And next Sunday.
And where we'll talk about last Sunday.
There you go.